The manager of a large office noticed an employee and asked for his name. The worker replied, "John." The manager scowled and said, "Look, I don't know where you worked before, and I don't know how it worked there, but I don't call anyone by their first name. It breeds familiarity. That leads to a breakdown in authority. I refer to my employees by their last name only. Smith, Jones, Baker. You got that? Okay. I'm to be referred to as Mr. Robertson. Now that we have that straightened out, what is your last name?" Whereupon the new guy sighed. "Darling, John Darling is my name." To which the new boss replied, "Nice to meet you, John." Names are important. The Bible is full of them. And a whole bunch of them come in the very first chapter of Matthew's Gospel, which is our text for this morning. But I've actually read that text, and it begets a lot of boredom. It's just name after name. And so I've decided to spice up our Bible reading for today. It's just a little bit. And I'm not going to read the text directly as it's written. So you won't hear me say the Word of God at the end of it. But it's in there. I'm just going to add some explanation of who some of these people are. But I also need you to help me. This is what we are going to do. And the first service did it very well, so I have high hopes that you will do it well also. As I'm reading, I'm going to give you some hand signals, and I expect you to respond to them. I kind of need everybody to help out, so I've got someone in the back with a squirt gun. Actually, I don't, but I wish I had. Here's what we're going to do. When I do this, what do you think your response should be? Yay! Yep. You know, cheer, clap. If I do this, good. You're catching on. Now, this one's a little more difficult, and they had some difficulty with this. The next two, they kept confusing. But if I do this, huh? Huh? It's just, got that. Huh? Okay. And then if I go like this, remember we're talking about people. So if I go like this, who? Who? So, really? You've got it. So now to Matthew chapter 1. The book of genealogy of Jesus Christ. Yes. The son of David. Yes. The son of Abraham. Yes. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Yes. And Isaac the father of Jacob, who stole his brother's birthright. Yes. And Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers, who sold Joseph into slavery. And Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, by Tamar. And Perez, the father of Hezron, and Hezron, the father of Ram, who has a car named after him. Ram was the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nashon. Nashon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz by Rahab, the prostitute. No, just... Huh? Yeah, my bad. Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth, who is a great woman whose story is told in the book of the Bible which bears her name. Obed was the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David the king. David the king was the father of Solomon, by the wife of Uriah, who he murdered. Solomon was the father of Rehoboam, who was a good king. But one who disobeyed God for several years of his life. Rehoboam was the father of Abijah, who had 14 wives. And Abijah was the father of Asaph. Asaph was a good king, but later disobeyed God and died of gangrene of the feet. Asaph was the father of Jehoshaphat, a king who ruled wisely most of the time. And Jehoshaphat was the father of Joram. And Joram, the father of Uzziah, whose pride caused his downfall. Uzziah was the father of Jotham, a very good king in every way. But Jotham was the father of Ahaz, a very bad king in every way. And Ahaz was the father of Hezekiah, who cleansed the temple and reestablished the kingdom. Hezekiah was the father of Manasseh, who ruled for 55 years, but was evil for most of that time. And Manasseh was the father of Amos, and Amos the father of Josiah, who did right in the eyes of the Lord. Josiah was the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation into Babylon. And after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel, who was a governor chosen by God. Yeah. Zerubbabel was the father of Abiud. Abiud, the father of Eliakim. Eliakim, the father of Azor. Azor, the father of Zadok. Zadok, the father of Akim. Akim was the father of Eliud. Eliud, the father of Eleazar. Eleazar, the father of Mathan. And Mathan, the father of Jacob. Not the one that was mentioned earlier. Jacob was the father of Joseph the carpenter. The husband of Mary. Of whom Jesus was born, who is called the Christ. Thus we are told of the family tree of Jesus. And what a strange tree that is. Great highs and great lows. Well-known names and names that we hardly remember. And amazingly, the names of both men and women. For including women in a genealogy was not really normal. Today, we're going to look at the four women in that genealogy. And next week we'll look at others in this genealogy. But these four women teach us so much about the family of God that it's worth investigating why Matthew would put these four women into the genealogy of Christ, because their inclusion in Matthew chapter 1 reminds us that there is great hope for the holidays. It begins with a very basic fact about these women. All four of these women were pagans. And there is hope for the pagans. Tamar was a Canaanite. Rahab was a Canaanite. Ruth was a Moabite. And Bathsheba was, if not a Hittite, she was at the very least married to a Hittite. Now, this doesn't seem that significant to us today, but it was extremely significant to the Jew of Jesus' day. Because the dividing line between the Jew and Gentile was one which represented huge differences in the way you responded to one another. And although from early on in Genesis there was the promise that every nation of the world would be blessed through the nation of Israel, there was still this idea that there were people who were in the family and people who were out of the family. And that if you weren't born into the family, if you didn't have a Jewish line, you were plumb out of luck. The best you could do is become a God-fearer. But you couldn't be fully integrated into the family of God. And here in the first chapters of the New Testament, God says to us, you are welcome in my family. And it's possible that somebody here is Jewish by bloodline, but it's unlikely. Which means that all of us are impacted by the inclusion of the Gentiles into the family of God. And a part of the Christmas message is that we are all capable of being included in the family of God. That the family of God is not merely reserved for those people who were born with the right parents. There is hope for the pagans. There's hope for the outsiders. There's hope for those who don't have the privilege of birth to be in the family of God. There's hope for us. Interesting side note is that not only were they pagans, but they were women. And that was not a good thing. But part of the gospel story is the elevation of women. Part of the gospel story is that women are important. Part of the gospel story is that God has bestowed his love not merely upon men, but upon women as well. That God is an inclusive God who has invited pagans, who has invited those on the outside to come in and be a part of his family. There is no longer Jew or Gentile, slave nor free, male nor female. There are simple people who are part of the family of God. This is an integral part of the gospel story. The second thing we learn from these four women, not only is there hope for the pagans, but there is also hope for the powerless. The story of Tamar is found in Genesis chapter 38. It's a passage which you've maybe read. It's only one chapter of Scripture, but she is amazingly mentioned again in Matthew chapter 1. But in Genesis chapter 38, we read the story of this Canaanite woman who marries one of the sons of Judah. And the Scripture tells us that he was wicked. So wicked was he that God eventually killed him, had him die. And in that passage, it plays out something which is alluded to in the New Testament when Pharisees come to Jesus, Sadducees come to Jesus and say, there was a man who was married, he died without a child, and then his brother took his wife to have a child, and he died without a child, and there were seven of the men married her. You remember that story? That talks about the Levirate law, which said that if your brother got married and didn't produce a child, then you were by law required to produce an heir for him. And that story is told in the New Testament. Well, it's played out in Genesis chapter 38. In Genesis chapter 38, Tamar gets married. Her husband doesn't give her a child. He dies. And so Judah tells his next son that he is to go and he is to produce an heir. But read the story. He didn't want to do it. And so he does some things which infuriate God, and God brings judgment upon him, and he dies. So she is now twice widowed with no children. And she goes to Judah, and Judah has another younger son. And Judah says, yeah, I'll give him, you know, when he comes of age, then he'll take care of business. Only problem is that Judah didn't want to do that. And as the younger son keeps growing up and he comes of age, she realizes that he's not going to keep his word. And she's powerless to do anything about it. She lives in a society where women are not valued. And now she is at the mercy of Judah, and Judah has decided to reject her. When the story goes on in Genesis 38, that she dresses as a harlot, sits at the gate of the city, Judah comes, and he sees this beautiful woman, she's wearing a veil, he doesn't recognize her as his daughter-in-law, he hires her as a prostitute, he doesn't have the goat to pay with, so he gives her his staff and his ring, and says, I'll pay the next day. And so the next day he sends one of his servants with a goat, but the harlot at the gate is gone, nobody even knows that there was a harlot at the gate, because there wasn't, she trapped him. She gets pregnant. The problem with being a single woman and pregnant in that same age is that that was punishable by death. And so she is publicly humiliated. Now she is this widow who is pregnant, and obviously there's some hanky-panky going on that shouldn't be going on, so let's kill her. And she then produces Judah's staff and his ring and says, the father of the child owns these. And Judah says something incredible in that passage. He said, she is more righteous than I. And she gets included in the genealogy of Christ. Someone who was totally powerless, who was not able to fend for herself, who had to come up with unacceptable means to survive. And she's included in the genealogy of Christ. The second woman in that story is the woman Rahab. You remember Rahab, her story is actually contained in Joshua chapter 2. It's a story where they're coming into the promised land, and they come into the city, and she ends up harboring the spies, and she's a prostitute. One thing about prostitutes, very, very few prostitutes go into business because they just like selling their bodies. She had no place to turn, nothing to do. Powerless in a society which was male-dominated. And this woman makes it into the line of Christ because there's hope for the powerless. Or how about Ruth, the Moabite, who is part of a nice family circle with her husband, his dad and mom, and her brother-in-law and his wife, and all the men die. And they got to figure out what to do. And she's powerless, so she goes with her mother-in-law to Israel, and she gleans from the leftovers of a field for Boaz, and the text tells us that she slept at Boaz's feet in total faith that somebody else would take care of her. She's living at the absolute mercy of other people around her. Totally powerless to take things into her own hands and to make stuff happen. And she's included in the genealogy of Christ. And then there's Bathsheba. Her story is found in 2 Samuel chapter 11. And she's actually in Matthew, she's just referred to as the wife of Uriah. And you remember him, he was a soldier. And he's off fighting the king's battles when the king plays Peeping Tom. Now, some people suggest that, you know, Bathsheba was trying to lure him. However, the traditions of the day suggest that probably she was just doing what other people did, that they often had baths on their roof and you weren't supposed to look. You know, the polite thing is to avert your eyes. And so she's married and she's bathing and, you know, David's got his binoculars out and okay, maybe not, but she does catch his eye, and the king comes knocking on her door. Now, I asked this in the first service. How many of you, if the Secret Service called you and said, President Obama would like to speak to you, would really say no? You might say, well, I'm not of that political party, so I don't want to talk to him. But how many of you would think, wow, I get the opportunity to talk to the president? Most of us, although we have the right to say no, most of us would say, yeah, I'll do that. I got a few things I'd like to say to the man. If he wants to talk to me, I got some, you know. Bathsheba couldn't say no. The king of Israel comes, and he has the ability to say no or die. Or, you know, say yes or die. So he comes knocking on her door, and she is summoned into his bedroom. And no matter how congenial it was, she didn't have the choice of saying no. Totally powerless. Totally abused. Totally taken advantage of. And she makes it into the genealogy of Christ. Many times we feel powerless. We feel there's things going on around us that we can't control. We can't possibly hope to make it through because no matter what we do, there's always somebody who's stronger or more powerful, and there's hope. There's hope for the powerless because God is on our side. So not only is there hope for the pagans, there's hope for the powerless, but these four women have something else in common. These four women have experienced intense pain. There's hope for the pained. For people who have gone through experiences that nobody wants to go through. Think of Tamar, who experiences the pain of not one, but two husbands that die, who then experiences rejection from the person who was supposed to take care of her. And then she experiences public humiliation because she's pregnant. She's not supposed to be. Incredible pain. Rahab, we know the least about the pain in her life, but how about Ruth? Ruth, who has the pain of a husband that dies, the pain of leaving her home and traveling to a foreign land in the hopes that someone will take care of her. And then there's Bathsheba. Imagine this. No matter how you play out the scenario with Bathsheba, it's not good for her. If she was a full, willing participant, if she really didn't like Uriah and she enticed David, there had to be a time when she looked in the mirror and said, "What on earth did I do?" Like right after David murdered her husband. Not only is the guy that you just slept with a philanderer, an adulterer, but he's a murderer. There's a good trade. Uriah, the honorable man of integrity for David. And she does get pregnant, and what happens to the child? The child dies. I'll tell you what. In 33 years, 35 years of ministry, I've seen people who have had a child die. There are a few things which crush a heart more than losing a child. I've sat with people whose spouses have died. Their life is drained out of them, full of pain. So whether it's Tamar or Rahab, Ruth, or Bathsheba, these four women give us this incredible picture of people who are full of pain and included in the family of God. That's pretty cool. And that's where it comes to us. Because for each of us, we're all pagans. We're pagans by birth, outsiders. We don't belong to the family of God, except through this thing which was initiated way back in the book of Genesis, but came into being as God became flesh. And in a much more dramatic way, opened the home of heaven to us. That God has said, it's not about whether you have the right parents. It's about your faith. That God has said to each of us, you know, no matter how powerless you may feel, and we live in a time when often it seems as though we are totally powerless. Some people suggest that if we just all carried guns, then we'd be safer. We would have power if we just all carried guns. Frankly, I've met a lot of people who I hope never get a hold of guns. And even if we all carried guns, it doesn't prevent somebody from getting trigger happy. The reality is, in our world, we are powerless. We are only preserved by the grace of God. And no matter how powerless you feel in your individual life, whether it's at work or at your home, God says, enter my family. Where the powerless have been given the power to become children of God, the right to become adopted into His family. And maybe you aren't experiencing pain today, but if you live long enough, you will. And unless the trumpet sounds, you know, real soon, it's likely that sometime soon you're going to face pain. A spouse who dies, a child who dies, a parent that dies, someone who rejects you, someone who says things which hurt. We're going to experience pain. And here's the cool thing. The genealogy of Christ reminds us that there is hope. There is hope for us. There is hope for all generations throughout the holiday season because God saw fit to include the pagans, the powerless, and the pained in his family. There is hope for us. Really? There is hope for us. Yeah.